You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This is Evan Bogart, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine, and let's get into it. This is a big one. Part one of a two-parter, part two coming up next week with my man, Evan Bogart. If you're not familiar, Evan is a hit songwriter, music publisher, record executive, Grammy winner. He's worked with Rihanna, Beyonce, Jason Derulo, a long, long list of superstars. And he's an old friend of mine. He actually worked for my company briefly many, many years ago when I was doing artist management. And he would come to my office during the day, and then at night he would go in the studio with Eminem making that first album. And Evan's career is absolutely incredible. He's got some tremendous ups and downs that he's going to talk to us about, and just some crazy lessons learned. He's also the executive producer and music supervisor of the new movie Spinning Gold, which he made with his brother Tim and his other brother Brad. And it's about their father, Neil Bogart, who's a recording industry legend. He was the founder of Casablanca Records, which was the home to Kiss and Donna Summer and the Village People and Parliament Funkadelic, and really defined the disco era. So we're going to talk today about Evan's amazing history in the music business, and like I said, some crazy shit he went through to get to where he is today. And next week we're going to come back and we're going to talk all about the movie. So let's get into it right now with Evan Bogart. Well, there's a lot more I want to talk about the movie, but I want to talk about you.
Okay.
And obviously we've been friends, we've known each other, I think 25-ish years,
yeah,
something like that, and had the pleasure of getting to work together for a little bit of that time. So, do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
I'm not sure if it's exactly the first record, but it was either the Fat Boys,
okay,
or License to Ill.
Both awesome records.
Either way, it was the same year. It was 86.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So I was 8.
Yeah. And so, yeah, obviously when we met, you were a crazy hip-hop fan and rapper.
Yeah.
And so how'd you, I know you obviously grew up in a musical family, but you were rapping as a teenager. How'd that happen?
Are you saying that rapping isn't musical?
Yes, you know that's my strong opinion.
How did I end up rapping?
How'd you get on the mic?
Or how did I end up in a musical family?
No.
I loved rap music from the moment I heard it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it resonated with me in a way. I really connected with the rebellious nature of it,
mm-hmm,
and the feeling it made me feel kind of like, it made me feel like I don't want to say tougher, but like it gave me confidence mm-hmm. in a way that I didn't have naturally.
Sure.
I think. And then I wanted to be the person who like knew all the lyrics by heart at like birthday parties. It's like I can impress the girls and stuff.
Sure.
And the songs would come on. So I learned all of the songs. Nice. Like literally I would transcribe all the lyrics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'd write them all down and memorize them.
Wow.
I think at one point, me and two of my good friends in elementary school, like shortly after License to Ill, I decided I was Mike D and the other one was Ad Rock and the other one was MCA. And so we would learn all their parts.
Nice.
So like if the Beastie Boys songs, like Paul Revere come out at a birthday party, we would all do the parts.
That's a really smart way to do things.
It was really impressive to like fourth graders and third graders and shit.
I mean, that's a smart way to do things.
But I was like very early on into like very obscure. I think I learned it from like watching Yo TV Raps.
Yeah.
And shows like that.
Sure. Rap City,
yeah. But like really, really early on, I was into like some really obscure shit that people were like, what? Like, and I remember I was like the first kid who like, I remember going to like Music Plus in Westwood mm-hmm. and being like, do you guys have Wu-Tang Clan? And they're like, who? And like, cause I had seen like the Protect Your Neck video or whatever. Or like I was the kid who showed up at school with like the Deep cover cassette, and people, mm-hmm. and I remember this one kid, older kid, going, "Snoop Doggy Dog, what a stupid name."
That's awesome.
He's an idiot.
Where's that kid?
No, but dude, I showed up. I showed up in seventh grade, wearing like Public Enemy medallions to school in seventh grade and shit.
Awesome.
Like, and I was like a fan of like, you know, in retrospect, like a lot of pretty. Anti-Semitic rap music or like gangster rap, you know, I just really, it's pretty eclectic in my tastes. I felt like a real affinity to like, I remember going to summer camp and I just started to think of things I listened to in summer camp are like Big Daddy Kane and Kool Moe Dee and, mm-hmm. and, a lot of commercial stuff like Young MC and Tone Loc and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But then, also like some pretty, pretty obscure shit. Eric B. and Rakim and stuff mm-hmm. that like, you know, 10-year-olds aren't really listening to. but I'll say this, when I was 10, I heard Me, Myself, and I mm-hmm. and fell in love with De La. My brother Brad, my older brother Brad, played me the 3 Feet High and Rising album for the first time and mm-hmm. I was like, holy shit. I was totally blown away by it.
Yeah.
And I became a lifelong card-carrying member of the Native Tongues family. Like, mm-hmm. I just obsess over everyone in that crew. And then, you know, became like probably I consider myself the biggest Tribe Called Quest fan on earth. Back in the days on the boulevard of Linden, we used to kick routines and the presence was fitting. It was the abstract. But I'm sure people would.
I know people, some folks that want to challenge.
Challenge me on that, but I'm a pretty big Tribe fan and De La fan, but mostly Tribe. Black Sheep, obviously.
Yeah. So I find
JBs, but I didn't know about the JBs until after De La and Tribe. Like I went back and learned. JBs obviously were way earlier, but like I was young, but I didn't connect with it. Like their shit was also on Rap City and Young TV mm-hmm. Raps and stuff. But mm-hmm. I didn't connect with it like when I first saw, you know, De La or.
I mean, they also lacked the
Boogie Down Productions or.
Commercial is not the right word because all that music is. It's hard to label that music.
The Jungle Brothers were less accessible.
Right.
They just were.
Yeah.
They just were.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? And then Cabron White. Do you know Cabron?
No.
He's Maurice White's son.
Oh, okay.
From Earth, Wind & Fire. Yeah, yeah. But Cabron and I went to elementary school together. Nice. Cabron played me NWA mm-hmm. for the first time. And it was the Effel for Zagan album.
Mm hmm.
Which I'll always call it that because they gave us the ability to call it Effel for Zagan.
Sure.
I fell in love with NWA, went back and listened to all of the earlier stuff.
Yeah.
I went to an NWA Public Enemy concert with Cabron and my friend Ollie and my stepdad. And the NWA came out to a barrage of machine gun fire, which everybody like hit the deck because they thought it was real. And then Public Enemy came out. Chuck D did like a 45-minute speech about how the man is the devil. And I was like, it's like, okay.
That's awesome.
I just was in love. I was in love with everything about it. It didn't matter to me. Like I didn't, I didn't know half the shit they were saying.
Yeah.
I mean, even the Beastie Boys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think I understood with, like, you know, my manager's crazy, he always smokes dust. I didn't know what that meant when I was a kid. I rapped it, though.
Right.
He's got his own room at the back of the bus. Like, I knew all the lyrics, but, like, I didn't know what the bus was. I didn't know what smoking dust was.
Fair enough.
You know?
That's hilarious.
I didn't know what the Eggman was. I didn't know any of that shit when I was a kid, but, like, I loved it.
I didn't know what Cookie Puss was, because I'm not from Becky.
Yeah. I love Doc Canelli, too, though. I didn't know what that was, either. But something about putting it in your mouth.
She said, put it in her mouth, mouth. Yeah. I mean her motherfucking mouth, mouth. She said, put it in her mouth, mouth. Yeah. I mean her motherfucking mouth.
But one thing that strikes me is, right, so you were sort of part of a social circle of Beverly Hills hip-hop kids that I started hanging out with.
If there was a reality show, if reality shows existed back then, Beverly Hills hip-hop kids would have been a huge...
Yeah, for sure.
Really popular show.
Absolutely. I think a couple of those people were on reality shows.
Eventually, yes. Yeah.
But what was interesting, because I'm older and I grew up, you know, I just had a different experience, right? And so one of the things that struck me was like how underground the taste of that group tended to be. Like you guys.
Oh, dude, I listened to so much. Like the underground shit I listened to. It's like so beyond, like, I can't have conversations with people today about things I listen to. I'm like, oh yeah, you guys remember Yag Fu Front?
Right.
They're like, what?
Sure.
I'm like, yeah, the UMC. Like people don't, like most people, even like people are like, oh, I was a hip hop head in the 90s. And like, yeah, well, Yag Fu Front,
right.
You know? And they're like, what?
They
and I'm
like,
step to the left. You step to the, like, I've never heard that song. I'm like, all right, never mind. Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is like now you make pop music.
Yeah.
And so at the time, obviously, culture, you know, was different, but hip-hop had a very antagonistic relationship to pop music. And
oh, yeah.
So how does that background and that music that was so formative to you, how does that shape the music that you make now?
I mean, it depends what I'm writing now.
Mm-hmm.
You know... The through line connection is that I write music. When I write music, I try to figure out how it's going to make people feel.
Mm-hmm.
And the music back then that I listened to made me feel a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know there's a lot of, like, talk about, like, suburban white kids, you know, listening to, like, gangster rap. You know, when I was growing up. That was the thread, right? That was, like, the whole, like, thing, right? Like...
Yeah.
Really, you know, because it's something you couldn't be and it was dangerous and stuff like that. Honestly, it made me feel like there was like a freedom to it, a mm-hmm. rebelliousness. It wasn't the danger of it, but it made me feel like I was part of something that wasn't the norm, the commercial norm of it. And it made me feel a certain way. And then as I got into other music, other types of hip hop, like I feel like certain things would make me feel another way. Like if you think of like when I first heard Tupac, Dear Mama, mm-hmm. I cried. Mm-hmm. That made me feel that way,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, you know, I hadn't, obviously my mom wasn't in jail, like a fainie, but I lost my father.
Sure.
Like I found like some sort of like through threads there and stuff like that. I think great music makes you feel a certain way.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter what the genre is. So for me, like I try to write music that makes someone feel something.
Mm.
Now, I like writing music that makes people feel happy for the most part.
Sure.
I'm not like a big like sad songwriter. I'm not, I just not, I never have been. I've written a couple songs that have been sad. There are people who are amazing at that. And I don't really like writing about sadness.
Right.
That's just not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
I like writing things that are like, either like.
I mean, knowing you, you're always an upbeat person. You know,
yeah, mostly. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so like, it's just not fun for me to sit in a room and like toil over something that's like depressing.
Yeah, it doesn't sound fun to me either.
But some people thrive in it.
So was it a foregone conclusion that you were going to work in music? Like, or did you, yeah. or did you ever, did you explore anything outside of music?
No. I like flirted at one point with maybe going to like sportscaster camp.
Okay. That's crazy.
Just a moment in time. Other than that, it was always music.
Okay.
I didn't know what I'd do in music.
Right.
I always assumed I would do something like my dad.
So talk about that, because you had twists and turns. I looked you up last night. I didn't even realize you spent time as a booking agent.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spent time together doing management and yeah. in the Interscope mailroom. And
yeah.
So it took you a little while to sort of find your
yeah.
lane.
Yeah. Well, in seventh grade, I bought an SB 1200 and Techniques mm-hmm. and a Neumark mixer mm-hmm. that also had a built-in sampler. So I can get like a few more seconds of sampling time.
Of course.
Than my 12 seconds that uh-huh. the SP came. Or 8 seconds, or whatever the SP, right. SP came with. But the, you know, and then I started recording with all my friends who rapped and like, or wanted to rap, and we mm-hmm. would like write stuff. And like, so I thought, there was a point in time where I thought I'd be a performer. Mm-hmm. When I was 16, I started interning at Interscope. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 18, I started working in the mailroom there. And then I tried to get myself a deal. Trugman and I went to New York with my
dad. By the way, labels love that when you work there and you're trying to get signed.
They didn't know.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't I was advertising it.
Right.
But me and Justin Trugman went to New York uh-huh. and took some meetings with my demo. It wasn't going to happen. But we did go to the... Where was it? Like, was it the Flatbush Mall or one of those? Okay. One of those. We went. Amazing. We were wearing North Face puff coats and Tim's.
Of course.
And we went there so that Justin could go front shopping. He was looking to buy Emerald Fangs.
That's awesome. Not surprising.
Yeah, it was good. Good times. Anyway, but and so I just was like, I'm not gonna get signed. And but it was funny, when I made my demo, I was splitting studio time with the Alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And we were working at a studio called Yo Mama's House.
Oh yeah.
Behind the liquor locker on Sunset. Nice. With the engineer was 40 to the head, Fred, who did all the Alcoholics records.
Sure.
And so we were splitting the days up. It was like either the Licks and then us, or like DJ Honda, mm-hmm. or like a few other people were in there at any given time that we were there.
Nice.
I did my demo. Baby Doll sang on it.
No way.
Remember? Do you remember that? She sang a chorus on it.
I did not remember that.
Oh, Baby Doll sang the chorus on one of my songs on my demo.
Lila James now.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So then I was working in the mailroom at Interscope, so I just kind of settled in for that ride, and I thought, you know what, I'll just work in the business. I won't be, I'll be like my dad, you know? And then shortly thereafter, I was working on my first project, which was the first posthumous Tupac album, mm-hmm. Are You Still Down? Where I got to meet like amazing people like Soul Shock and Carlin and Tony Pizarro, and you know, obviously spent a lot of time with the Fainey and mm-hmm. the Outlaws and Thug Life and Mo Preem and those folks, and then right in the middle of that, that first Eminem album. And so I worked a lot on that, Slim Shady LP. Mm-hmm. I guess depending on who you talk to, I either discovered it or I didn't.
Sure.
I did, but...
We know you did.
But, you know, whatever.
Take... Here's what I've never asked you.
Yeah.
Because I know that story, and I know you found that and brought it in. So when, I've told this on this show, one of my great moments as a manager was, you know, we had started working together, and you're like, M's looking for management. We should manage him. And I remember saying, and I had heard the demo, and I was like, yeah, this dude's incredible. I don't really know about white rappers. I don't think anyone's going to give a shit. But
no one really knew about white rappers.
Fair enough.
It was Vanilla Ice and Marky Mark.
Yeah, in my defense, right? There was no precedent for it,
none.
It was something that I personally had no love for. Not M, but just white rappers in general. There were no white rappers that I loved. I mean, Beastie Boys I kind of put in their own category, but it wasn't my thing.
Right.
And so I remember saying, like, I don't really care about this, but if you're into it, like, let's take the meeting. And then I think we had a phone call with him, and it didn't go anywhere. And in retrospect, I was certainly not the right manager for him because I didn't think it was the greatest thing that the world needed to know about.
Yeah.
But I totally missed the boat on it, right? And I was dead wrong.
A lot of people missed the boat
on it. Yeah, of course. And that's kind of what happens
with a lot of these things.
So I'm not beating myself up about it. But but what I've never asked you is, what'd you learn going through that? Like, you found this thing that you knew. I mean, everyone knew that, like, Evan knows this is the greatest shit ever. And you were proven right. And you didn't get the credit that you might have gotten, or the you know, you didn't have the opportunity to sign that and you know, really launch your career in the stratosphere that it might have happened if it went a different way.
Sure.
What'd you learn from that experience?
To be more open to receiving help. Mm. And to not try to be such a lone wolf and do things on my own.
Yeah.
You know, I had the benefit of my mom, who was a successful manager. I could have gone to it any time and been like, what do you think I should do here? Right. You know, like, but instead I just was kind of like, I winged it.
Yeah.
And at the end,
I did a lot of that around that time. And that's a big regret for me.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of people that could have helped me. Sure. You know, if it wasn't my mom, like people in her network, people she knew in the industry could have advised me on how to handle that situation the right way. Mm-hmm. Or could have even gone to Jimmy, people that were like notable. If my mom knew that was what's going on, not like on a tattle, tell my mom, mom, I'm not getting credit on this record. But like, look, I mean, what I didn't learn from there, which I'm thankful I didn't learn from there, is not to trust people. Mm-hmm. Right? It would be a really easy thing to get fucked over by your best friend at the time.
Yeah.
Right? Let's just say, because I'm not like Voldemorting this, like Dean Geislinger. What up, Dean?
Dean listens to the show.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Dean. But yeah, I mean, like, I got screwed over by a fucking social climbing con man.
Yeah.
And who proved out to be that, right? Who tried to social climb his way through Hollywood and got fucking, you know, shoved out of Hollywood and never was allowed back in. But like, it would be really easy for me to take that as the lesson and be like, I'm not going to trust anybody. I'm going to like close up. I'm going to like, or like tuck my tail between my legs and like scurry off into another industry or something like that. And instead it empowered me to go do it again.
Yeah.
It empowered me to be better at what I do and empowered me to learn from that. The other thing was like, you know, I was like, I learned I should always have paperwork, but that's not also true. Like I've had a manager for 15 years that we're on a handshake and I would rather, you know, jump off a bridge and screw him over. Right. You know what I mean? He's a friend. And so I think what I learned from that is to not be afraid to ask for help and to know that you're not alone and you know that there's people around you that you can always tap into and get advice from people and not wait for somebody to come and save you to go out there and, you know, ask for help.
That's a great one. Well, while we're on the topic of lessons. So obviously, you know, you didn't grow up with your dad.
Yeah.
But you've heard the stories. You've now made a movie about his story. What do you think you learned from his legacy that you carry with you today? How has he influenced you in your career and your life today?
Well, I think his biggest influence in me is intangible.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's something that's like, you know, the nature versus nurture thing that like, you can't really put your finger on. There's things that like, mannerisms and things that I do that he did. And he died when I was four.
Right.
There's no way I would have learned that from him. There's very little video.
Sure.
Most of it's at the end of the movie, in the credits, right? Yeah. Like, there's not a ton of footage for me to like, have learned a lot of the things that I do. So I think there's like a trust my gut element of it. There's like a listening to the voice inside me, the ear. Like there's certain things about the tenacity, the passion for music, the belief in music, and the unwielding conviction about things that I think just come that are just genetic. Because I don't know, you know.
I mean, it's interesting. conviction.
My mom, by the way, was also a badass, right? Sure. And like, I learned a lot from her too, right? Yeah. And I think she raised me the right way. She raised me to be kind and generous, and like, there's a lot of things that I learned from my mom, which are pretty amazing. But there are also just intangibles that I just. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a little bit of nature and nurture, but I think from my dad, the thing that I've taken is heart is not something that I like intentionally took.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I appreciate that.
I kind of want to start a podcast called "Sorry, I Didn't Mean to Cut You Off."
Just two people talking over each other the whole time. I love it. I mean, you bring up a good point, which is that one of the things that stood out about your dad in the movie, right, is he knew, right, that these songs or these artists had to break. And there's a theme in the movie. I just need more time, right? And I think music in particular, but probably most of culture and society, was about people knowing that they were right and everyone else just didn't get it, and they set out to prove that to the world. And both like beautiful, amazing, and terrible consequences, right? If you think of all the people that just refused to accept society's not getting what they knew to be true.
I have felt that way about artists that have gone on to be humongous successes.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Eminem, for sure.
Yeah.
The fucking second I saw him,
yeah,
I was like, this is unlike anything that's ever happened.
Yeah.
And through the making of the album, and every time he would go on the beat mm-hmm. or Friday Night Flavors, or every time I would just hear him freestyle and be hanging out at the Oakwood Apartments, like, everything about him screamed, this kid is something special.
Yeah.
Even when the album was ostensibly shelved and they went and funded the Hi, My Name Is video out of their own pocket, Philip Atwell and Dre and them, and paid for it out of their own pocket. And I remember walking it onto set and looking at DJ, Jimmy's nephew, mm-hmm. and saying, where's M? And he's like, it's right there. And I turned around to the left, and he was sitting there in Marilyn Manson makeup. And I was like, this is going to be fucking huge. Yeah. Like, as soon as I saw him in the Marilyn makeup, in the makeup chair, I was like, holy shit.
Amazing.
But I felt the same way with Maroon 5.
Yeah.
You know, when Jordy Feldstein and I were taking that around and shopping it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was passing. And I was like, these songs are hits. Like, what are people doing? You mm-hmm. know, I remember I don't want to like just keep putting people on blast, but like I remember an executive, we'll just say, at the Interscope showcase, leaned over to Jimmy and whispered in Jimmy's ear, they're just a Jamiroquai ripoff. Let's go.
I'd love a good Jamiroquai ripoff.
Sure, right?
Yeah.
Like, why not, right?
More people would rip off Jamiroquai. Jamiroquai is incredible.
And and they were playing things like Sunday Morning and Secrets, like songs that ended up being like iconic records on that Songs About Jane album. Like, they didn't have This Love.
Yeah.
And that they had pretty much everything else on the record.
Yeah.
And everybody passed. Everybody passed. Only James Diner and Octone, the only people who made an offer.
Mm. That's
literally one small label under BMG with an upstream component to J Records.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, he passes. Maroon 5 never happens.
Crazy. I mean, that's so interesting, and it's like there's thousands of these stories, right? And movies. And
same thing with One Republic. Everyone passed except for Velvet Hammer. Yeah. David Benveniste. Bino. Yeah. The only person.
I didn't know he worked with One Republic.
Bino signed One Republic to Velvet Hammer. They made that whole album, and then Columbia ended up dropping. Like, I feel like, I think they said something like 50 Cent, Katy Perry, One Republic, and the Jonas Brothers all in the same week or something like that. It's like famous, like, week of Columbia dropping these four artists that went on to become massive stars all in the same week.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously, Tim picked it up. But Tim, you know, Tim's uncle, Marcus, was managing One Republic when they were signed to Velvet Hammer. Mm-hmm. So it made sense. You know, sure. Ryan had been signed to Beat Club as like a ghost producer during like the Bubba Sparks days.
Got it. Crazy.
So, you know, they already had a pre-existing relationship. But again, even back then, like before Tim had a label, like Velvet Hammer was the only company that made an offer on One Republic. No one, even Diener, when I went back to Octone with it, after Maroon 5 was already successful, said, I mean, I already have Adam. Like, I don't need Ryan. I already have Adam.
Sure.
I'm like, That's silly. You could have had both, right?
So we were talking about the kind of twists and turns. So songwriting, obviously.
Yeah. Was so the like thing. So the label Interscope.
Yeah.
Till like 98.
Right.
Right. 90 around that time. Uh-huh. I went to I don't know if you remember this. I went to Immortal Records.
Oh yeah.
I was so pissed. Good I timing. went down to Interscope, and that I was so young again, not asking for help, not right. asking for advice. I should have just been like, okay, cool. You know what? Fuck it. Go do it again.
Right.
Instead, one of the people who worked for Wally was like, I'm going over to this label. I know they did you wrong. Come with me. Mm. And I was like, yeah, fuck this. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And I went to Immortal, mm-hmm. which was the worst 6 months of my life. Sure. My last day at Immortal, I walked in and they were like, hey, I'm not sure this is working out. And I was like, me neither. Do I have to stay to the end of the day or can I leave now? And they were like, you can leave now. And I was like, cool, here's the key. Awesome. And I literally left and I drove right to you.
That's awesome.
I literally came right to you, and I was like, I want to learn how to manage. Teach me. And so...
Did I teach you anything?
Yeah, I think so.
That's weird.
I mean, you were managing the Baker Boys and mm-hmm. Kidney Thieves and... Mm-hmm.
Dub C,
yeah.
Yeah.
And Bosco.
Yeah?
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, I made a lot of cassettes. No, I mean, I did. I learned stuff.
We did
make a lot of cassettes. But and then, yeah, I went...
I mean, I learned a lot as a manager... what not to do in the rest of my career.
Oh, my God.
And the first one is what you said is asking for help.
Because
I used to be so terrible at that.
The worst, right? And, like, everybody right. was the worst at that.
Yeah, and I guess so.
I think everybody when they first got out is bad at that. And I encourage people, you're not on your own. Ask for help. You had a village around you. Build a village. First of all, build a village. Build a friend base, you know? Like, maybe you can be like, what would you do in this situation? And don't be like... Like, let your ego drive that, right? Like, I think that's where people are like, well, if I show weakness to them, they're going to think that I'm not, like, I don't know my shit. It's like,
you're 100% right. And now that's all I care about is learning.
I ask people questions all the time.
Oh, that's all I want is to learn, right? But I think back to those, you know, I was 23.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to spend an afternoon with Lior and with Russell and with, Craig, you know, multiple afternoons with Craig Kalman. I didn't learn a fucking thing from any of them because I was... too busy trying to project
like who you are, what I do. Right? Yeah.
So stupid.
Yeah, we all are. We all do that. Yeah.
So what was the? When did you realize that like you had found your thing?
Well, so in when I was working with you, I went to the Winter Music Convention with my cousin Todd, mm-hmm. who was like in the electronic space, and he was kind of like. Helping out people like DJ Dan and Roy Davis Jr. and like nice. Donald Glaude and like he was like friends with all like the
that's cool.
Moonshine people or whatever. So he's like, come to Miami with me for Winter Music Convention. And when I was there, I met I bumped into some guys I used to rap with, who were the group Styles of Beyond, mm-hmm. and I convinced them that I was a manager, and that I should manage them.
Nice.
And they picked me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, I don't know what I'm doing.
That's cool.
And then I learned, I did everything you could ever do wrong as a manager.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting fired like, you know, after 2000 Fold came out or whatever. I think after at least one or two very intense conversations with Divine Styler.
Right.
There was the writing was on the wall that I should bow out of this. And I decided to continue to manage, and I ended up connecting with Walt Licker. Uh-huh. And we started managing people together, like Planet Asia and Mystic, Zion Eye, Living Legends, like all that stuff. And that's when I partnered with Jordan, mm-hmm. and he came on and he brought in, you know, Karis Flowers, which became Maroon, and, mm-hmm. He was... I remember he was managing like Freddie Fox. Jordan Feltz, managing Freddie Fox.
That's hilarious.
It's a funny thing to me. But I did management for a while and then that fell apart. And then I just was managing my own. I was managing this kid, Vicious, from Detroit, who was going to be like the next Eminem, mm-hmm. white rapper from Detroit. And I got him signed to DreamWorks.
Nice.
Michael Goldstone and Jeff Sosno signed him to DreamWorks. Uh-huh. And then this keyboardist who Trugman had brought in on the project, Justin and I signed Vicious together. He was signed to Justin's production company, and I was managing Vicious. And we brought in this keyboardist that Justin found from the Bay named Jonathan Rodham. Mm. And I ended up managing him. And I was managing Vicious and JR before he was JR. And then I met this girl. And I got into some partying. And headed down the wrong path, and it became more about the nightlife, mm-hmm. than the day, than the work. And Wally had hired me to do A&R scouting when he went to Warner, and I just kind of blew it all. I literally just fucked it all off. Like, I literally got fired by everybody. Vicious got dropped. I lost my gig at Warner. Like, and in 2004, I ended up moving back home. Mm. And got a part-time job working at a lamp store on Melrose.
Wow. I worked three, so you did have a job outside of music.
3 days a week working at Fantasy Lighting, which doesn't exist anymore, on La Brea and Melrose.
Yeah.
And on Saturdays, I would answer phones at Morton's.
Okay.
Not like Arnie Morton's, like Morton's before, uh-huh. before it was Jaconi's. Uh-huh. And and I was like living at home, like, you know, doing coke and... living the good life in my mom's guest room.
Okay.
And then I basically, my stepdad was like, you got to get a real job. And I was like, I got to work in the music industry, but I didn't want to go to a label and I didn't want to go to a management company because I had too much pride, of course. Yeah. I was like, I can't. I think I'm starting over. So I went to an agency and I begged for an assistant job. Ben mm-hmm. Gordon had introduced me to this guy, Josh Humiston, mm-hmm. Who was looking for an assistant. And
R.I.P.
I basically,
Josh.
R.I.P. Josh and R.I.P. Jordan. Mm. Unfortunately for both of them. They were both good, really good friends. Yeah. And I basically conned Josh into giving me an assistant job and told him I was gonna be a really good assistant, and I was terrible. But what I did say to him is, I can find bands for
I'm
you.
I'm sure he had a lot of terrible assistants.
Yeah, probably. I was like, look, I can find bands for you. Teach me how to be an agent, and I'll do anything for you as an assistant.
Nice.
And he said, against my best judgment, I'm gonna hire you. But we became fast friends. We became
that,
fast
yeah.
friends, and awesome. We were probably more friends than we were assistant boss. Yeah. And I loved him a lot. And he saved me. You know, yeah. he gave me a job when I really needed one. And about 5 months later, I got sober.
Yeah.
And then in my sobriety, I started feeling really creative again. And I've been sober ever since, like almost 18 and a quarter years now.
Nice.
You know. In my sobriety, I was like, I want to put together a girl group. Mm-hmm. And that's when the girl group happened.
Oh, wow.
In sobriety. Yeah. And then, you know, Zach Katz was managing JR, was mm-hmm. like, you should write the songs. And so I started wrote the songs. I was getting all my songs from JR uh-huh. before JR blew up, and Ryan Tedder before Ryan Tedder blew up.
Amazing.
I always say, like, if I was going to make that album 2 years later, it would have cost me $2 million.
Sure.
They became Amazing. Like the two biggest producers on the planet within 2 years. Yeah. But at the time, no one knew who the hell they were.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a little bit of like destiny, I think. I think it was just meant to be. I think that was the path I was supposed to be on. And,
yeah.
and, so it wasn't then though that I knew I could do it.
Okay.
I wasn't really sure. So I spent 4 months. The song goes number one. Mm-hmm. And the same day the song goes number one, I get made West Coast Club agent at KPA. Literally the same day.
Yeah.
May 6th.
Wow.
Insane. Right? And so now I was faced with this dilemma, like this company that like saved my life, basically.
Sure.
I'm not going to leave them
and you have a number high, one song.
High or dry, but they do have the number one song in the world in 20 countries. So it's kind of a dilemma here.
Crazy.
And so I became the West Coast club agent at APA, and I was booking all the clubs from like, you know, Seattle, all the way from Seattle, all the way down to San Diego and, you know, everything in between. And, you know, One Republic before they were One Republic and a couple other bands. And I don't know. Like, I didn't know what to do. So about 4 months into it, like, Zach was like, every day, Zach and Jared would call and say, you got to leave the agency. I was like, I can't leave the agency. I got a job. I got an insurance, expense account, like, office. Can't leave. I'm sober. Can't leave. You got to leave. You got to leave. We need you in the studio. And at night, I'd go there in the studio. But, like, we need you during the day. And, and finally, they were like, what's it going to take for you to leave the agency? And I said, I don't know, put me in the studio with Britney Spears. And then the next week, we spent the entire week in Vegas working on Blackout.
Wow.
And I came back and I quit. And I went and wrote full time. But even then, I didn't feel like, I still felt like an imposter.
Yeah.
You know, like I was a one-hit wonder. And JR quickly, soon after, signed Sean Kingston.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really working on that. It was a rap project. Yeah. His name wasn't Sean Kingston. It was Franchise. He was a rapper signed to Net Worth, which was JR and Zach's company through Epic.
Yeah.
And then he went in. Do you know Sly?
No.
He was a songwriter that worked with Dre at the time. Anyway, Sly and Sean Kingston went in. And the next morning we came in and it was the chorus to Beautiful Girls. Mm-hmm. And overnight, they were like, we're singing everything.
Sure.
So I came in and rewrote a lot of the songs with Sean.
Wow.
To be songs.
Amazing.
Not rap songs.
Yeah.
And Tommy Rodham, JR's brother, named him Sean Kingston. His name is Kashawn Anderson, and his family's from Kingston, Jamaica. So he changed the name to Sean Kingston, and he became a singer, basically, overnight. And they changed the name of the company from Net Worth to Beluga Heights. And it was this legend was launched. And that, and then Take You There came out as, like, the third single, and obviously became, like, my second hit. Yeah. And then I felt like, you know what, I can do this. That was the moment that I felt like I could do it.
That's amazing. I think that the, you know, people call it imposter syndrome, whatever, that I think that feeling is so important.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
No, it sucks.
But it's essential. I think, you know, first of all, the people that don't have that are really, you just don't want to be around them. Like, Elon Musk probably doesn't have imposter syndrome.
No.
Because he's just a garbage human being,
right? Yeah.
You don't want to be around, right? Yeah. But, and obviously you could take it too far and it can be crippling or whatever, but managing that, working through it is such an important part of getting to where you're going in life, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't, thanks for sharing. I didn't know a lot of those details.
Imposter syndrome, my pleasure. I mean, like, my imposter syndrome to me has a bit of humility in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what informs imposter syndrome.
For sure.
Right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. And we need that, right? Because
I don't ever really actually feel like, I hope they don't find me out. You know, I hope they find, you know, whatever kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, man, like, you know, I think as a music creator, it's hard for you not to sometimes be like, man, do I really have it?
Right. Yeah.
Like, have I just gotten fucking lucky?
Sure.
You know, like, and then you have to, like, think about moments where you came up with something that no one on earth could have come up with.
Yeah.
And the moment that the lightning struck your head, you know, and you're like, oh, yeah, I have it.
So, you know, now you're super successful and all that shit.
That's what it says on my LinkedIn.
What do you, exactly. So that experience of your career falling apart, moving back home, starting over. What do you carry with you today? Like, how does that help you today, having gone through that?
I always talk about moments in life where you have to pivot. Mm. I think a lot of people hit these walls and they're so dejected by it that they retreat.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people in, like, the music industry will have these, like, lulls, like these lows, and they don't come back from it.
Yeah.
And I think that it's hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the music industry and probably other industries, but the music industry from my own experience is a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of riding the waves.
Totally.
And I think sometimes people get so low in the wave that they can't ride it back up.
Yeah.
And what I learned many moments in my life, whether it was the Eminem situation, whether it was the management, you know, the situation of throwing everything away and moving back home, starting over as a booking agent, making the decision to leave the booking agency and go be an unemployed songwriter.
Yeah.
Albeit having a number one, but still no promise of number two, of second number one.
Yeah,
right? Then signing acts again. And then most recently starting a brand new company in 2020.
Yeah.
And from scratch with in institutional money partners, you know, money in investment partners, private equity partners. But like it's all about, for me, it's all about these moments of pivot.
Mm-hmm.
Like I take things a certain way and then I find ways to, like, pivot and grow from it.
Mm-hmm.
Pivot and grow from it. Mm-hmm. Like, that has been the kind of through thread of my career.
Like
travel on this journey, and then I hit a fork in the road or a wall. And I figure out what's my growth path.
Yeah.
How do I go, instead of, like, I can't go through it, and I'm not going to go back.
Right.
So how do I grow around it?
Wow.
You know, like, Tupac with the rose and the concrete, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah, yeah. like I think it's similar to that. Like, yeah. how do I grow this vine around the wall that I just hit and sure. through the cracks so it grows again into another the next thing.
Yeah.
And so I call it pivoting. You know, like I've made my entire career and personal life out of pivoting, getting sober.
Yeah.
Going through divorce, getting remarried. Having a child, mm-hmm. Dealing with death, dealing mm-hmm. with loss, dealing with, whatever, lawsuits, thing, any, whatever that comes your sure. way, right? And I think there's an understanding of acceptance, which I think comes from my sobriety, mm-hmm. Serenity mm-hmm. prayer and whatnot. I think I'm really in tune with acceptance and I think from that acceptance, once you accept something, you're able to grow from it.
Yeah.
And I think it's the denial and the resentment and the fear that holds people back. And by the way, it's not fun right. sometimes to pivot.
Yeah, sure.
And it's not fucking scary.
Right.
But one of my mottos is lean in. Mm-hmm. I have it written on a sticky note. On my desk, taped right. to my desk at home. And for me, it's all about like when I think about waves,
yeah.
right? And I think about riding these waves.
Yeah.
And I think about when you're in the ocean and the wave is gonna crash on you. If you turn around and you run from the wave, it always mm-hmm. knocks you over.
Sure.
The only way to not get knocked over is dive into the wave, right? You have to go through it. So like I think about that as like lean in. And yeah. shit gets tough, lean in.
I mean, I love that. And I also think, when we're successful, we make up stories about that we deserve it, that we earned it, that it was all about us, or that we're entitled, or right. And some of that's true. It's not, there's truth in that, but it doesn't teach us things, right? If anything,
yeah,
it almost makes the next thing harder.
Yeah, it hinders us.
Right,
it holds us back.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's that it's that ego that holds you back.
Yo, that was Evan Bogart on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you come back next week. We're talking about Spinning Gold. It's a great movie. I hope you go see it. In fact, your homework is go see the movie between now and next week so that you know what the hell we're talking about. And there we go.